Welcome to Meet the People of MCB with Kay Momquist and Chip Haley. Sponsored by the Missouri Council of the Blind. Let's get to it with this week's interview. Hello and welcome, everyone, to our first podcast of 2023. Happy New Year, everyone, and Happy New Year to you, Madam President.
Thank you, and I'd like to wish everybody else a Happy New Year as well.
No, you bet. Well, I tell you, I'm looking forward to today's interview.
Me too. I think this is going to be fun.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking forward to it. I want to have some fun with this individual that we're going to be interviewing today. So, ladies and gentlemen, it is our distinct pleasure to bring on at this time the person that Kay and I will be interviewing, and that is Robin Wallen. Welcome, Robin, to Meet the People of MCB.
Thanks, Chip. And hi, Kay, and good morning, and Happy New Year to everybody.
All right. So, Robin, you said you've heard a couple of the podcasts that we've done, so you kind of know how we do things. So we're going to begin talking about your vision loss. So share with us, what was the result or cause of your vision loss?
Okay. Well, I was actually born with congenital cataracts. When I was born, I actually only had light perception. And when I was about 3 months old, I had cataracts, well, not actually cataract surgery. I had an iridectomy to make an artificial pupil. And unfortunately, they did both eyes at 3 months old. They actually, when they were doing the right eye, the anesthesia started wearing off. They didn't want to give me any more. So they actually cut a nerve in that eye. So while I got vision back in that eye, I can't actually read with that eye because I have no muscle control. It's kind of a hard thing to explain to people because technically I see out of that eye everything about as well or better than I do in my left eye, but I just can't read with it. And even the doctors find that kind of confusing, believe it or not. So the way that this all came about after I was born, my mom noticed when I was about 3 months old that unlike other babies, I wasn't like holding my hands up, looking at them or grabbing for things. And that's when she realized I had a vision problem. So I went to Dr. Robert Drews, who actually is a really well-known ophthalmologist in St. Louis. He died several years ago, and it was actually his father that did my surgery, which was a really good thing because I think I was really lucky, because after that, his son took over the practice. And one thing that I was really lucky about was that he would never let anyone, even like if someone suggested doing surgery to improve my vision, he never wanted anyone to touch my eyes. And I feel really privileged about that in a way, because most of the people that I grew up around had so many surgeries that a majority of those people have lost a lot of their vision over the years because of scar tissue and different things like that. And I never actually had another surgery until I was an adult. And so that, I think, preserved a lot of my vision for a long, long time. Then when I was in my 20s, I actually had, well, actually, I think it was maybe a little younger than that. Anyway, I had a detached lens in my eye. It basically had come detached, and I literally walked around for almost a year with almost double vision. And I mainly my left eye. And the way I finally ended up doing something about this is I was at a friend's house and I realized I kept walking into walls. So I went to the doctor the next day and he sent me upstairs to his the other doctor that he had been training, which was James Bobrow, and who's another well-known doctor in St. Louis. And he said, you need to have the surgery. They both did, because the lens is going to rupture. And if you don't, you're not going to have any vision. So I had that surgery at that time. And what they didn't know is I'd walked around like this for a whole year, but, you know, so I was probably pretty lucky that I got away with it that long.
Yeah.
And then after that, when I was a little bit older, Justin was a couple of years old, I went and had cataract surgery on my right eye. And interesting story there, I had all the neurological tests, and they were amazed at how normal that all of this came back. And they really, truly thought that possibly I could get normal vision in that eye. Something told me that I couldn't, and I didn't get my hopes up. And honestly, I kind of feel like I grew up the way I am, so I don't miss anything that I've never had. And what came out not too long after that, the doctors thought I was crazy when I first said this, but later on it was proven to be true. In fact, they did research on it. The connection between your brain and your retina is developed in the first 3 months of life. And I was 3 months old when I kind of missed that deadline just a little bit. You know, I was just past the 3 month mark. And so that connection still isn't quite there. And it was a really interesting thing when I heard about it, because I had just asked the doctor if it was possible. And then actually 60 Minutes did a program about this, which really shocked me, because it was something I had never heard before, but it makes a lot of sense to me. And so I wasn't really disappointed when I didn't have perfect vision afterwards.
Okay, so then you considered high partial?
I would probably be considered more of a, I'm not going to say I'm a high partial, because there are actually high partials that see a lot better than I do. I would say probably moderate to high partial. And, you know, that's an interesting thing. When I try to explain, I've always had people ask me about my vision. And this is something that I really believe, and this is just my personal philosophy, that vision is kind of like a fingerprint. No one will ever totally understand it, because no one else will ever see through your eyes. So even to explain it to the doctors is almost impossible. Like, one of the big things that people always ask me, well, do you see blurry? And I say, well, to me, no. Maybe if you saw through my eyes, you would think it was blurry. But to me, it's not. And so there are people that honestly have the same acuity that I do, that maybe can't read print as well as I can, but have better depth perception than I do. So it's kind of a, you know, that's the thing about being a partial. It's kind of a weird Netherland that is so different from probably anybody else, and hard to explain even to somebody else, you know, that has the same thing. And the other, one other visual condition I have is as a secondary, and this was after my cataract surgery, I developed glaucoma, and they said it was secondary to the surgery. So that gives me about, the last time I had it tested, a little less than 5% as far as peripheral, you know, what central vision that I have, because I've lost a lot of peripheral.
Okay. Now, I really appreciate your explanation of the differences of, you know, being moderate to high partial. And even if someone has the same type of disease, everybody's vision is going to be different, just like you explained about with the fingerprint. I think that's a terrific explanation. So even though some of us have similar eye diseases, everybody's situation is going to be different. So thank you so much for sharing that. You talked a little bit or mentioned Justin, your son. Share with us your family, if you have brothers, sisters, and just share with us a little bit about your family.
Okay. Well, let's see. I grew up actually with a single mom, and I lived with my mom, my aunt, my grandmother, and off and on aunts and uncles and cousins. So we always had a full house in our house. And honestly, I think I'm privileged because I think I was raised by some very strong women, because these were women taking care of two little girls in the 60s and early 70s at a time when, let's face it, there weren't a lot of single parent families. And they faced a lot of stuff. And, you know, we were a really close-knit family. All of them are gone now. My aunt died my grandmother died when I was 13. My aunt passed away in 98. And my mother passed away in 2003. And the last couple of years of her life, she actually lived with Justin and I. And I took care of her, which was definitely a challenge because at one point she was on a feeding tube. She had to have all of her needs taken care of. I was literally working full time and taking care of her and raising Justin all at the same time. I do have, like I said, one son, Justin. I got married and had Justin in 88. And I ended up leaving his dad because it was kind of an abusive situation. And to be honest, I don't hold any grudges there because I think that, unfortunately, abuse runs in families. And so I ended up moving back with my mom and aunt and then stayed there till my aunt died, then talked my mom into moving into an apartment in Maryland Heights because we were not in a really good area. We were in a part of Youth City, University City, that had gone way downhill, and it just got to the point where even to get a taxi to the grocery store could be like a 4-hour challenge, which kind of explains my transportation advocacy. But anyway, so I just have the one child. I have one sister, Debbie, who is 8 years older than me. And everybody tells me that we're about as opposite as you can be. And in a lot of ways, we are. I also found out a few years ago, I actually did my ancestry DNA because I wanted to find my father's family, basically because of some health issues. Because I had a rather unique health problem. I had a problem with extremely low blood sugar. I'm not diabetic, but I have something that mimics reactive hypoglycemia. And when I did that, I was able to find my father's family. I had a name, which really helped. It actually went through about several adopted cousins before I found them, but I did finally find them. And I wanted to get a health history. And apparently there are at least three people on his side of the family who have the same sort of reactive hypoglycemia that's not really reactive hypoglycemia. It just mimics it. Nobody really knows quite what it is. And so in finding his family, I also was able to find out I had a half brother and a half sister. And kind of a funny story, you find this interesting. When I was working, I worked for a travel agency for a long time. It turned out that my half sister worked for the other big travel company in St. Louis, Meritz. And even though I never actually met her, I actually talked to her once because she was a recruiter for Meritz. And actually, I think a couple of times because she called me a couple of times about a job. But I never knew at the time it was my half sister.
Interesting. Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
So anyway, that's my family in a nutshell. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Now your significant other, Mark Dutchin, how long have you guys been together? When did you actually meet and how did you meet?
Oh, I got a story there for you. You're going to love. Technically, we've kind of known each other all of our lives without knowing we knew each other. This is a true story. So, after I moved back in with my mom, after Gary and I split, I had to get a job and I worked at the lighthouse. And so one day Mark came up to me and I was sitting at a table doing something. I don't know what I was doing. And he came over and he said, "Hi, my name's Mark." And I said hello to him. And honestly, most people don't believe this, but I was actually painfully shy most of my life. And so anyway, he said, I just thought you'd like to know. And I was like, okay, thank you. I didn't know what to say. So, you know, anyway, interestingly enough, we started working together on the whiteout line at the lighthouse, and we got talking one day. And he said, I grew up in Yosemite City. And I said, so did I. And he said, I used to live on Clements Avenue in an apartment. And I said, so did I. And then he said, I lived on Sheridan Drive. And I said, so did I.
And so far, man.
So far, he's believing me until he said, we were talking about where we lived, and he said, I live with my mom and aunt. And I said, so do I. And he looked at me and he said, you're lying. And I said, no, I'm not. So it's kind of a running joke that we sort of knew each other all our lives, but we didn't know it. He actually did know some of the people that my sister used to play with when we were kids, because she was 8 years older. He's 4 years older. So, you know, in an apartment. And I was quite a bit younger, so he remembers some of them. And I keep telling him that I still think he's the boy that threw the rocks at me in the tunnel in the park, but he says he's not. And anyway, so that's actually how we met. We met at the lighthouse, but I guess technically we were neighbors several times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, one last question before I turn it over to Kate, because I know she's just chomping at the bits to ask you some questions. So I take it that you've been a St. Louisan just about all your life?
Yes, I have been.
Okay. All right, Kate, I pass it over to you.
All righty. Well, Robin, we always ask this question. Can you give us a rough idea of, well, what did you go to public? First of all, I'm going to ask this. Did you go to public schools, or did you go to the Missouri School for the Blind, or what was your education level like?
Actually, I went to public school, a self-contained classroom, a resource room, and MSB. And I'll explain that. When I was really young, I started out in Yosemite City in a public school. I went to kindergarten, and I did really well there. But they decided, it was at a time when Yosemite City schools really didn't feel like they had what they needed to teach me. And so they told my mother that I needed to go to the school for the blind. So the next year, I was really disappointed because I went to the school for the blind. And at that time, they had a class between kindergarten and first grade called interim. And that was for the kids that came out of the public schools. And so I went to interim and first grade at MSB. And I was actually pretty smart. Not bragging on myself, but probably too smart for my own good a lot of times. And so by the middle of my first grade year, I was through my second grade reader. So they decided that MSB said that they didn't think it was the place for me, that they felt like they were holding me back. So then I went through special school district to a self-contained classroom. And I did that from second through sixth grade. I then went on to Brentwood High School, which was the school that they fed into at the time. And it was a resource room situation. And this is at a time when we didn't have ADA and 504 was still pretty new. And there was a lot of discrimination and a lot of really bad things that were going on. The school was getting rougher. I had some really interesting experiences there, I'll tell you. And keep in mind that I was a really shy kid. I was blind. I was a shy kid. I came from a single parent family, and I was always a little chunky. So I was always the one that was kind of the one picked on. So anyway, it was really rough in junior high. I actually had a teacher who literally, she did in fact fail every single one of her blind students. Even though I had an A in the class, it was an English class. I had an A in the class and she still failed me for the semester and for the year.
Wow.
And my sister's father-in-law at the time This was her from her first husband. He wanted to go to the school and argue with the school, and I begged him not to. I just wanted to let it go. And it was a situation where we actually had one math teacher that would not let us in math, which I'm sad to say, I am the worst mathematician on earth, because I literally made it through all of my high school years without ever having a math course, even though I was supposed to have one. I had one, but it technically didn't count because it was taught when the resource room teacher could actually teach me, which wasn't really often. So a calculator is my best friend. But yeah. Anyway, things got really rough at Brentwood. And I actually had a friend there who was shoved down a flight of stairs the year after I left by one of the sighted peers in the school and lost her vision. She actually had a unique situation because she had like an underdeveloped retina and her vision was getting better, but not after that happened. And I also saw that a lot of the kids around me, at that time, that was probably the big time when drugs were really big and a lot of stuff was going on around me that I just wasn't comfortable with. So I went to a summer program at MSB and I decided right then and there that I wanted to go back to MSB, which is something I will never regret doing, because I think that, and I will always say this, I don't think that public school is for everyone. And I think that if you're going to start kids out in public school, they need to start out early. I think like being in a self-contained classroom and not being put with other kids until fourth grade when they've already established friendships is a huge mistake. Not to mention, I think self-contained classrooms are probably not the best answer for anybody. And so I went back to MSB. And MSB is really where I got my voice and learned to talk and be friendly and sort of get a lot of confidence, because I was able to get mobility there. Probably the one thing that I will say academically, I did my senior year doing the same stuff that I'd actually done my ninth grade year in public school. And I understand part of why that is, because you have a lot more kids with a lot of different learning styles and a lot of different backgrounds, and you kind of have to be somewhere in the middle for everybody. So I don't really regret it. I think I'm privileged in that having been to so many different educational situations, it taught me how to get along with lots of different kinds of people.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. And I understand, because I was also what they called back in the day mainstreamed or whatever. So I went to both the school for the blind and public schools. And there's the good and the bad about all of them. So that's a really interesting story. And it's neat that you went back and you feel like that actually helped you out. I completely understand that. And that's it's a good thing, because at least you were able to perform and grow and with some kind of a feeling that you were appreciated and things were okay, and you didn't have to try to outdo yourself because you were with sighted people or try to get along, and you know how that goes. And as a kid, that's what we think about too, is fitting in and working. So that's a great story. So onward, you've graduated, you've come out on your own, and you have already mentioned to us that you have worked as a travel agent or with travel agencies. Let me put it that way. What is your work history like, and what all have you done?
I've done a lot of different things, to be honest with you. I worked at the Lighthouse, like I said. I did that for about 8 years, and prior before that, I did some different things. Like for a while, I was a personal care attendant for someone. And anyway, when I went to the Lighthouse, I stayed there 8 years. And the eighth year, that was at a time when the Lighthouse really didn't have a lot of blind people in the office. And I kind of felt like I wasn't getting anywhere. And I guess I just got mad one day and I decided I'm going to do something else. And so I had read that TWA actually had openings for res agents. And so I went down and I went to a I'm trying to think what it is, job fair downtown. I had my sister drive me down there. And I literally had to talk them into hiring me because what happens so often, and I think we all can relate to this, sometimes if you get a job and a blind person gets a job and they don't do well, then the next person who comes along, they're really leery of hiring them. And then you do well, and then the next person goes along and they expect more out of them than they can give because we all get shoved in this little box. So they had had an experience. They had had a blind reservation agent long before that, but then they had recently hired one that was having a lot of trouble. And so when I went to the job fair, I literally had to sell myself. I was just bound and determined that I was not leaving there without that job. So I said, look, this is my, and I went in, and a lot of people disagree with this, disclosing that you have a vision problem. I have always done that because I feel like this. If I want them to trust me, then if I want to trust them and they want to trust me, then I need to be honest right up front. And quite honestly, when you're a partial, you have to hold things close to read them, and eventually they're going to figure it out anyway. So I told them, I said, look, this is what I really want to do. I can do this. I have the personality for it. I like people. And this is how I'm going to do it. And I just basically told them anything that they came up with. I told them my vision and I said what I would do and how I would do it. And so they decided to hire me and give me a chance. So I went down, I went to their training, and first thing I did was I walked in with my cane, which, as you guys probably know, for a partial is like a big adjustment because when you're a partial, at first you don't want to use a cane. I think that's perfectly normal. I think you feel vulnerable and I think you feel like you stand out. But something just told me to take that cane, and I'm going to tell you that cane for me was a game changer. Because then, if I would do anything silly, they understood why. Because, like, the first day I went into the class, I went in and I sat down in the classroom and I didn't realize that there were name things up above each computer. They had a little nameplate for everybody in the class. And the girl sitting down next to me and she goes, hi, Barbara. That's really cool that there's another Barbara in the class. And I said, I'm not Barbara. And she said, oh, your name is back in the back. And she said, can you see? And I said, I can see, but I'm legally blind. So anyway, it explained it. And I think that that was kind of an icebreaker because then people understood when I did silly things like that, you know, without realizing that I had done them. And so I went through the training at TWA and I was there for a while. And that actually is what really started my interest in transportation because getting to that job was a nightmare. I lived in Maryland Heights. There was no way to get downtown on a bus at 7 a.m. from where I lived. I was trying to use CallRide, and basically, CallRide told me that they didn't go that much of a distance because they said it was 19 miles and they didn't go 19 miles. Which led to a really big problem because basically, what we were able to work out was I would take a CallRide to the North Hanley Metrolink station, the North Hanley Metrolink to the Wellston station. Then at the Wellston station, I would take the Page bus downtown. And then, because I wasn't real comfortable walking around downtown at 6 o'clock in the morning, I would take another CallRide from the Metrolink station downtown over to my job at TWA, which was on 15th Street. Then, coming home, some days I would have a ride, some days I wouldn't. It became such a nightmare that this was around the time that a lot of people had filed complaints. I actually ended up filing an FTA complaint because of stuff that was going on with CallRide. And that's when I started learning a lot about the rules and regulations because I didn't really understand them. And so it became a huge fight between me and Colorite. And I think a lot of people were really uncomfortable that I had done this because, of course, everybody worries that when you stir up things that you're going to take things away, which was never, ever, ever my intention. I never intended to do that, but I also needed to get to work. And so at one point, I actually had a reporter from the Post-Dispatch follow me to work. By that point, Colorite had kind of given in a little bit, but they said they couldn't always take me because their vans were full. That wasn't a good thing because when the reporter followed my van, the one day that they took me straight to work, there was nobody on the van but me. And so at that point, I ended up sometimes getting a straight ride, sometimes not getting a straight ride. Sometimes having to take the buses all the way home, which was a disaster in itself because basically I would walk from 15th over to the Civic Center station, take the Metrolink out to the Wellston station, where the only page bus that went near where I lived only ran like two times in the morning and two times in the evening. So I would have to sit there for 2 hours at the Metrolink station waiting for a ride, the bus to go on home. And so I followed, like I said, I filed the FTA complaint. And at one point, we actually did have someone after my complaint come to UWB from the FTA and talk to people about what the rules and regulations were. And it was a huge eye opener for me. But anyway, getting back to that, so I was at TWA for a while. Then a gentleman who owned an aircraft finance company saw my problem about getting to work in the paper, and he called and asked if I would like a ride to work. And so he started providing me rides to work. And he also was a big donor to the Lift for Life Academy here in St. Louis, which was a, it's a charter school. And he drove me down there to TWA for a while, but it was hard on him. And quite honestly, it was hard on me. And during my FTA complaint, I had some real retaliation, and I had some interesting experiences with Colorite where I was literally taken to a house I hadn't lived in 3 years, and I had to beg the driver to take me home. I was taken to a transfer point where I was left for 2 hours. They sent a van to take me back downtown, and luckily I had drivers who knew me and would take me home, and it was not a pretty thing. So this gentleman who owned the aircraft finance company asked me if I would like to come and work for him because he needed a receptionist at the time. So I ended up working there for a while. Not a job I really cared for, I'll be honest. First of all, I like talking to people. Secondly, I didn't like sitting at a desk and writing checks all day. And I just didn't feel like it was the right place for me. And what ended up happening, I, at the time, was wearing extended wear contacts, and I left them in too long, and I got a corneal ulcer, which actually affected my vision, and I was off work for about 3 weeks because I couldn't see to read anything. And I finally decided that he and I kind of came to a mutual understanding and agreement. He let me go, and I was fine with that because I really hated it. And then I, not too long after that, after my vision came back, I went to a job fair for a place called MasterCard Rewards. And basically, it was a travel rewards center for credit card points. And I went there and I applied. And again, I did the whole job fair thing. And I told them how I would do my job and, you know, what I used, and that I used magnification, that I used Zoom text, that I understood airline reservation systems. I knew WorldSpan. I could learn Sabre, which is the other big one. And so I started there, and I went through their training class, and I got through that. And I will tell you, going back to TWA, you haven't lived until you've done an airline training class, because it's like living in a real life game of Survivor. Every time you have a, you always had to maintain a 98 or better to stay in the class. And so every time we would have a test, we would go back afterwards and you would see who wasn't left in the class. We started out with a class of 14. We ended up with a class of 4.
Wow. And
so it was stressful. In fact, after a while, they started sending us to break so that we wouldn't see who was gone right away because people were getting so stressed. Well, anyway, wanted to backtrack on that because I will tell you that was an interesting experience that I don't think anybody wants to go through. So anyway, back to MasterCard, and sorry for jumping around. That's my habit. I started working there, and we were affiliated with MasterCard for quite a while. And then MasterCard moved their offices out of Maryland Heights. I was worried I would lose my job. It didn't turn out that way because we got other accounts. And so we started doing rewards travel for other credit card companies. And eventually we became known as Connections Travel. And we were owned by Carlson Companies, which is a big travel company. They also own restaurants. They own some other different things. And honestly, I didn't know how big this company was for the longest time. And I was actually shocked when I figured it out. But I was there through a lot of changes, and I was there 10 years, I guess, and absolutely loved it. And one of the highlights of my career there was I was able to go to Minneapolis, Minnesota for a reward ceremony, and I actually won a customer service award that through the whole company. And that's when I realized how big a deal this was, because I thought this was going to be a minor thing. It wasn't. They had people from all over the world there. They gave awards for customer service and travel and hospitality and restaurants. And so there was a huge like production. We had entertainers. We had a huge reception. It was a lot of fun. And I was able to meet the owner of the company, and I was really privileged to have such a great supportive company. Well, eventually they did sell the company, and what you may, if you were at the ACB convention, one of them in Minnesota, the owner of my company, I actually got him and the president and vice president, I got them to be volunteers at the ACB convention.
Wow.
So they were there, and I thought this was really cool because we had a town hall meeting one day and Eric came in and he said, I got something to show everybody. And he's from Scotland. So he says my name, interestingly. He always says Robin. He said, I want to show everybody what I got for Robin. And so he had got a t-shirt. Him and Travis, our vice president, had t-shirts made. And so if you were at that convention in Minneapolis, this was, I can't remember what this year was. It was like in the early 2000s. And you probably had the chance of meeting him because he, Eric, Travis, and our HR person were all volunteers. And I know that Eric and his wife raised dogs. I don't know what kind of dogs they were. They were very expensive dogs, but they loved all the guide dogs because they kept talking about all the guide dogs and how cool they were. So anyway, Eric sold our company, and or not Eric, but Carlson sold the company. So Eric and Travis bought it so that none of us would lose our jobs. And we were there for a long time until eventually they ended up selling to someone else. And eventually when I left because of a health issue, we were owned by another company altogether. But I kind of saw the writing on the wall because at that point, most of the people that I started up with were making really, really good money. And what was happening is they were letting people go right and left and hiring people with no travel experience to take over more of a call center thing. And so I kind of inadvertently gave them the way out without meaning to, because I had 2 knee replacements and I couldn't work for a long time. And I used all my FMLA, I used all my vacation, and when I couldn't come back because I couldn't get out the door of the apartment, they let me go. So that was a sad story into that story, but it was a really fun job. It was rewards travel. We did, like I said, credit card travel. Most of the people we worked with had $100,000 or better credit limits. Most of the people who called us were, believe it or not, financial advisors. Yes, if you have enough money, financial advisors will book your travel. But anyway, it was a fun group. I had such a supportive manager. In fact, one of the things that happened was, funny story, I had a rehab counselor who is gone now that did some really crazy things, like bought me Zoom text and a computer with no memory and then gave me no monitor. Which I thought was really bizarre. And I actually called the office and I said, I don't have a monitor. And she said, what? And I said, yeah, Zoom text without a monitor is kind of not a good thing. You know, you have to have some something to put the magnification on. So I had literally taken in my own monitor to the office. So one day, Mike, our manager at the time, when we were connections, he sent a friend of mine over to the door to get me. And she said, go to your desk. And I said, why? What's going on? And I went to my desk and the company had bought me a brand new 27-inch monitor. And he said, I can't believe that you brought your own monitor in. Take that home. And he put a big bow on it. So I mean, I was really blessed, the people that I worked with. And the other big thing that I got to do while I worked there was, contrary to what people think, when you work in travel, guess what? You don't travel as much because you're usually booking other people's travel. But we did actually do a work conference cruise. So one year, the same year that I went to Minneapolis for the awards, we actually were able to go on a 7-day cruise to the Caribbean, Western Caribbean. And basically, Mark got to go too. He just had to pay his taxes and port fees and his own airfare, but everything else was paid. And so anyway, we went on that cruise and that was a lot of fun. It was work during the first half of the day. And then the rest of the cruise, we could do what we wanted. Although I will say we skipped the captain's dinner because I was so tired of changing clothes 3 times a day. I was done by the end of it. So that was kind of one of the really neat things that we got to do. Then after I left there, I actually dabbled in corporate travel for a while, but I am not a corporate travel person. And I did some work from home jobs, but I will be honest with you, I do not like working from home. I thought it would be wonderful. I thought it'd be great. I was really, really excited about it. I thought no more transportation issues. But what I missed was people and the people connection. And also, I was really lucky that I always had really supportive IT people that would work with me with my software and make it work, even when we added new programs. Because I was telling Chip earlier that, you know, we had like 6 programs we had to log into. And if you don't think 6 programs that you're logging into on top of an airline system and then Zoom text doesn't cause problems, you have no idea. But I always had really good tech support people. Well, what I found when I worked from home was that they weren't seeing what I was seeing. And that became a problem because I would try to explain things to them and I would say, look, you know, I can't do this because it's not working. And they would say, I'd often get answers like, well, I wear glasses too. And I'm trying to explain this to people. And it just didn't work out well. So anyway, it was a fun job. I still like travel. Right now, I'm really happy I'm not working in travel. And I'm really happy I'm not dealing with anyone who is flying Southwest.
Well, that's great. That travel industry must be rather fascinating, and I'm sure you run into some really interesting individuals dealing with travel. But all that having been said, I'm going to let Chip run from here because I can just guess some of the questions he's going to ask. But It sounds like you've had a really varied work history, and that to me is great just to hear that you've been into a lot of industries that I guess industry would be okay. It's a lot of different types of work experiences that a lot of blind people probably have not had. So I think that's really neat. Chip, would you have any questions?
Well, actually, I really do, but unfortunately, we're just really about out of time here. So we're probably going to have Robin come back maybe at another time. So what I'd like to do here, Kay, why don't you go ahead and ask your question that you always like to ask, and we'll just go ahead and close it out with that.
Okay. Yeah, because we want to find out how you got involved with MCB, and there are several things that I could think of that we would like to do. But the question I always ask people, Robin, is what has Robin done that nobody else knows about? Maybe your closest friends do or whatever, but it could be a hobby. It could be anything else like that. But what kind of surprising thing have you done, or do you still do even, that no one else knows about that they might find really interesting?
Okay. Probably people who know me really well know that I used to be a big time. I used to love to write. I used to write a lot. I actually had some poetry published in a college literary magazine, and I was always a big writer in school. I wish I still had that talent. I don't have that talent as much now. I try to get back into it, but I just haven't really done that as much. But people who really know me know that that was always a big thing for me. I always loved to read, and I think growing up that's where I got the love of writing, was just reading so much. And probably the other thing probably is just the things that I've told you about, you know, as far as like my looking for my father's family. Not a lot of people know about that. And I'm really privileged that I was able to meet some of those people.
Well, there you go. That's great. Chip, would you like to take over from here? And
yeah, so Robin, we really do appreciate your being our special guest here today on Meet the People of MCB. You've been a marvelous, wonderful guest. You've got so many fascinating stories to tell. I wish we had a whole lot more time. And like I said, we really got to have you back, as Kay mentioned, because we want to hear how it was that you actually got involved with MCB. We know now that you are currently the MCB Transportation Committee Chair, and I don't like using the word chair there, but that's what it is. So, and I mean, just listening to you talk, I mean, you can really pick up very quickly that transportation is a passion, one of your passions. And so having you as our Transportation Committee Chair, we just feel so blessed and so fortunate to have you doing that. So again, thank you for being our special guest here today on Meet the People of MCB.
Thank you, Chip. And I enjoyed it.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you know someone that you would like for Kay and I to interview, you can have them call me, Chip Haley, at 417-540-9703.
Or you can call me, Kay Momquist, at 608-436-2610.
Wishing all of you a very happy new year. Enjoy your week, everybody. And we'll catch you right back here next time. You never know, you might hear yourself here on Meet the People of MCB. Bye-bye for now.